This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Hear the story of a young woman who got into Harvard on a swimming scholarship and realized she was trans and was a he.
KP as a woman felt inauthentic to me because it's not who I am, and then I needed to really take that risk. And part of that risk was risking being terrible on the men's side.
Skylar Baylor became the first trans male athlete in Division I sports. He talks with Mary Cullen before an ISU appearance. Plus, there are some eerie parallels between the election of 1860 and 2020, according to political scientist Bob Bradley. WGLT's arts correspondent Laura Kennedy brings us a story that stitches together a communal art experience to give power to those seeking change. And Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy offer our gardening podcast, Grow.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Imagine devoting your youth to a competitive sport, coming to the realization that you are the wrong gender, and then having to choose whether to give up that sport. That's the choice Skylar Baylor thought he faced. But Baylor went on to be the first ever openly transgender NCAA swimmer and the first trans male athlete documented to compete in Division I for any sport. Baylor is the keynote speaker at this year's LGBTQA cultural dinner at Illinois State University Friday. He tells WGLT's Mary Cullen he doesn't consider himself to be a role model.
I think that's for other people to decide, but what I do say about myself is that I'm somebody that can prove that this is possible, and that was what my primary goal was to do when I came out. I decided to be public about it because I wanted to show younger people, specifically younger trans athletes like myself, like I was like when I was a kid, that you could totally be yourself and also do what you love. So in that sense, I guess that does define, I guess people define that as a role model, but I don't know. I feel sometimes weird about calling myself that.
Let's take it back to when you were in high school. So you were recruited to swim on Harvard's women's team after high school. And by the time you were a senior, your name had already gotten national recognition, right? So you were one of the top 20 15-year-old breaststroke swimmers, and you were also on a relay team that set the national age group record. So then in a gap year before you started at Harvard, you transitioned. Can you talk about the pressures that you may have felt knowing that you were on the track as one of the country's top young women in swimming?
Yeah, I definitely felt like potentially transitioning was potentially giving up all the success that I had worked my whole life to achieve. I've been swimming since I was less than 1 year old. I've been competing since I was six. And like you said, I sort of became somebody on the national scene around high school. And that I really worked my whole life to do. And so one of the biggest struggles for me during my transition was figuring out if I wanted to give up being a female athlete. I initially was not going to transition because of that, because I valued my own success and my own hard work in the sport, but I ended up deciding that I needed to prioritize my own happiness, my own authenticity, and that continuing to compete as a woman felt inauthentic to me because it's not who I am, and then I needed to really take that risk. And part of that risk was risking being terrible on the men's side, you know, and that definitely felt confusing and sometimes bad, you know, disappointing to me, having worked so hard to be a competitive athlete. But I decided to take that risk, and it was well worth it.
When it comes to giving advice to maybe some young listeners who are still trying to find themselves, or even older listeners who are still trying to find themselves, how did you know that you were ready to take that step and transition?
I don't think that that's one of the things that you know 100%. Like, I don't think I sat there, you know, decided to transition, decided to go to college, decided to be on the men's team all at once, being like, yeah, I can totally take the pressure of also being, you know, a quote-unquote role model for others. But I think that it's the best way to say it is that it didn't matter to me what the pressure was, which I don't mean to say in a sort of careless way, but rather that the impact that I potentially saw in what I was in being public about myself was like, it so far outweighed the potential stress that it was going to give me. And I remember having a very specific conversation with my coach, the men's coach, when he offered me the spot on the men's team, and we started talking about what that would look like. He said, you know, Skylar, we don't have to tell everybody, you know, you don't have to be this poster child. You can just, we could be as quiet as you want about it, or, you know, as quiet as possible about it. And I looked at him and I said, absolutely not. If I decide to do this, I want to be open about it. Not that I'm going to go screaming, you know, from all the rooftops, this is who I am, although I ended up doing that from, you know, stages and other outlets. But it was more that I was going to be open about it. I wasn't going to hide it at all. And I said, the reason I need to do that is because when I was a kid, I saw nobody like me. I didn't see any queer athletes, much less trans athletes, much less trans athletes of mixed race and of color. And I need kids to see that, because kids need to see that, especially kids like me. And so I will be open about this. And that's 100% the reason that I do any of this. Why I do the speaking, the reason I'm doing this speaking tour now, the reason I'm talking to you, is to prove that to younger kids. And so that impact to me, and you know, I get almost daily messages, emails, DMs from people saying that I've saved my story, or you know, awareness of my story has saved their life because they see possibility now. And that means the absolute world to me. So I don't think, to answer your question more directly, sorry, this is a bit long, but I don't think I sat there thinking, like, of all the stressors that was going to come, because I was naive to those stressors. But I thought to myself that the impact I could potentially have was worth anything, really.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Skylar Baylor, the first openly transgender NCAA Division I swimmer. You touched on a little bit there in your response, the supportiveness from the Harvard coach. So how did you approach that conversation and explaining and saying, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is why I want to do it, and how did they perceive your transition and support you in your journey?
Yeah, so I was recruited by the women's coach. The women's coach at Harvard, her name is Stephanie Morawski, or Steph. And Steph recruited me beginning in the spring of 2013, so the spring of my junior year in high school. And I committed on September, I believe, 20-something, 27th maybe, of 2013, that fall, the fall of my senior year. And she majored in psychology. She went to Harvard. She actually had records on the Harvard swim team as well. So very versed at Harvard is my point. And when I decided to take a gap year, I only knew it was that I had mental health problems. So I told her about that. I said, I have an eating disorder and I need to get better from it. So I actually am taking a gap year. And, I asked her, what does that mean? And she was like, listen, that's totally fine. I'm just going to have you a year later and you're going to be more mature and you're going to be better able to take care of yourself. It sounds great. So she's very supportive of that. Then about halfway through treatment, I called her to tell her that I'm trans. And was freaking out about that. I was like, I was potentially going to lose my spot on the team, I thought, or lose swimming altogether. And she said, listen, I don't know what it means. You know, I don't know what that implies, but I do know that we'll take care of you and we're going to figure this out. And if you want to swim, you will. You have a spot on this team and we'll figure it out. So that was sort of my first step into knowing that it was going to be okay, at least on Harvard women's swim team. But then as I kind of progressed forwards and decided I wanted to transition, I wanted to go by male pronouns, I wanted to get a mastectomy, that's the sort of removal of breasts, masculinization of chest, I wanted to present as male and be perceived as such, she was like, this doesn't seem to match up with being on the women's team, like let's look at other options. And that's when she talked to the men's coach. And actually, talking to the men's coach was just asking for advice. She wasn't asking to put me on the men's team. And Kevin, the men's coach, just said, wait, so Steph was saying, you know, I don't know what to do. I have this kid. What do you think? And Kevin was like, wait, so you have a person who identifies as male, wants to swim at Harvard and is already into Harvard. You know, why does I coach a men's swim team at Harvard? Why doesn't he swim for me? That makes a hell of a lot more sense, right? Excuse my language. It makes a heck of a lot more sense. So they brought that to me. I said no initially, actually. I was so terrified by the concept. And it wasn't that I was ungrateful or anything. It was so absolutely terrifying and world shattering, honestly, to me at the beginning. I couldn't even conceive of that. And I was so scared of what that would mean, to attempt to be the first trans person on a team. So it took me a while to, it took me about a month of really intense thinking to say yes. And after which, Kevin was always supportive. He was like, you can definitely swim on this and we'll figure it out. I think we all had no idea what we were doing. It was not, none of this was coming from places like, we know a lot about gender. We know a lot about how to practice diversity and inclusion on a sport. It was more, hey, this kid is struggling. Let's do what's best for him. And both of the coaches, Steph and Kevin, are parents. And both of them said to me independently and together, we cannot, you know, push you to swim on the women's team out of any sort of good parenting skills. Like, we want you to be happy first.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like you had a really great support system to not only lean on, but to push you forward.
Absolutely. Very grateful for them.
When considering that support system, of course, we know a lot of trans or LGBTQ community members don't have that strong of a support system. And even from your perspective, I mean, you have national support. You were on The Ellen Show. You were on 60 Minutes. You were in Washington Post. So you have this following, these people that are supporting you. But do you still find yourself being the target of judgment?
Absolutely. I don't know any trans people who don't get judged at some time. You know, I think that's the sad truth right now, is that trans people are still sort of very marginalized peoples in this country, in this world, in this society. And yes, I please don't get me wrong. I am so, so grateful for my support system. And I feel, as a result, I feel very loved and safe and like I have a space in this world, which is something that is life-saving, literally life-saving, to me and to many people. But that doesn't mean that there aren't still spaces in which I don't feel as safe, or where, you know, I've had interactions that are incredibly detrimental to my sort of mental health in certain ways. And I try to talk about them, you know, insofar as I feel productive, but there are some times when people are just mean people, you know, there are just mean-spirited people out there, and some people you can't change, and sometimes I have to let those go. So there was a kid that I interacted with a couple of years ago, just, you know, in life, who was around quite a bit, and it was tough to be around him, and so I set boundaries. And I had enough of a support system around me that it didn't matter this one kid was sort of a bad actor, but it did matter. It hurt me, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's still spaces that hurt me. And so I guess the reason I'm saying it this way is that there are, you know, I think there's plenty of trans people who have people who hurt them because of their identities. And a lot about it is being able to set boundaries, even if you have to see the person consistently.
On a related note, in an interview with your alma mater, you told the Harvard Gazette that constant questioning centers you and helps strengthen your conviction that this is who you are. What advice could you give to those who have similar struggles, and how they can turn that questioning and negativity into a little bit more of a positive thing and a growing thing?
Yeah, so the first thing I always tell people who are questioning is that we live in a world that tells us questioning is bad, that you have to be sure, that if you're not sure something's wrong with you, that being unsure of yourself is bad. And I like to challenge that. I think it's okay to feel, you know, unsure about something, especially about who you are. I don't think that anybody sits down and is like, I am 100% certain that this is 100% of who I am 100% of the time. I think that's ridiculous. I don't think trans or cis people feel that way. And some people might feel that way, you know, in some scenarios. I can't obviously know or speak for everybody. But in my opinion, it is rare that people know anything for 100% certain 100% of the time. And that's okay. I think that we need to talk about the fact that it is okay not to know every answer about yourself, and to see a perspective shift between doubting yourself and wondering about yourself.
So you mentioned that you mentor a lot of people, you are on this public speaking tour, you're sharing your story, you're enlightening audiences about the trans community. So what would you say you identify as our biggest struggles as a nation when it comes to trans acceptance?
So my biggest focus point is kids, younger kids in elementary and middle schools and high schools, because I think that is a place where anybody has the power to really educate our youth, which educates the whole nation over time, right? And with kids, I think the biggest pushback towards trans people, not with kids, just with people in general, is the idea that it's like abnormal or wrong or not real, right? And I think a lot of that comes from lack of exposure, some sort of sometimes sort of like conservative belief systems, I think. But I don't think that's it, because I've met plenty of, like, I mean, what I mean by that is I don't think that's 100% it, because I've met plenty of conservative people with conservative belief systems who are very accepting of me and have no problem with trans people. So I think it's a combination of different belief systems, but in my opinion, the core of all of that is a lack of exposure and a lack of education. And the problem is that after people are about 20 years old, really about 15, they're kind of like done learning in a lot of scenarios, especially like what they truly believe about the world. You really have the power to impact their beliefs. It's not even beliefs. It's just like what they see in the world, and expose them to what's quote unquote normal and what's real in the world by just exposing kids to things when they're kids.
That is WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Skylar Baylor, the keynote speaker at ISU's LGBTQA Cultural Dinner, 5 p.m. Friday at the Marriott Hotel and Conference Center in Normal. We have two important words we want you to hear. Thank you. We heard from hundreds of listeners and web users who contributed during the fall fund drive, and it's still not too late to make your contribution at WGLT.org. We are grateful. So many value what GLT brings to Central Illinois with NPR and award-winning on-air and online local journalism. If you just didn't get around to making a contribution yet, you still can. Let us know that WGLT is important to you. Contribute at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, WGLT's Grow looks at how not to pour money into your lawn. Abraham Lincoln's presidency was historic for several reasons, but his election in 1860 could also offer parallels to what might happen in the 2020 presidential election. That's according to Bob Bradley, a retired politics and government professor at Illinois State University. Bradley is hosting a talk at the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington October 10th. Bradley tells WGLT's Eric Stock the division that anger and the time over slavery and immigration in the U.S. gave rise to a major shift in political parties that we have not seen since then, but he thinks we could next year.
1860 is classified as a major critical election in U.S. history, primarily because of two things. One is that you had a political party, the Whigs, disappear, and a new party emerge, which was the Republican Party. And then you also had a substantial shift in voters from a coalition of Democrats, Whigs, and some other third parties to the new Republican Party, which at its time was viewed to be very progressive, which I find very interesting. 2020, I think the same thing could happen. I think both parties are in jeopardy of ceasing to exist as we now know them.
How do you think the Republican Party, as it's currently constituted, could go the same way as the Whig Party because of the way President Trump has essentially overtaken the party?
I think one of the things down the road in history, Republicans have to be concerned about historians and how they treat their party. And that is particularly congressional party Republicans. Are congressional Republicans going to be known for this time period as being acquiescent to the racist policies and other policies against other elements of society associated with Trump? That they just didn't stand up for that. And that's what they're going to be known for. And is that what they want to be written in history about them?
Well, many conservative leaders have openly criticized Trump in much of the same way that liberals have, but the polling still shows that Trump has a support of a majority of Republican voters. Is it realistic to suggest that many of those will defect? Wouldn't that have to happen for the Republican Party as we know it to no longer exist?
Well, Trump won in the last presidential one because of the defections of a fair number of people in suburbia to the Republican Party. And then also he gathered a fair amount of support in the South in regard to the Republican Party. Though we're seeing in Georgia, this recent congressional race in North Carolina, that the South is not as solidly Republican now as they think it is. And I think the economy is going to have a lot to do with this. If, in fact, we go into a recession, and depending on the severity of that recession and how long it lasts, I think you could see mass defections from the Republican Party.
You'd mentioned the Democratic Party is also in peril. What could cause that party to transform into something else or go away entirely?
The problems with the Democratic Party are twofold. First of all, how are they making an appeal to the newest generation of voters, those that are 18 to 25? I find it just sort of amazing that perhaps the oldest nominee for the Democratic presidential bid is the person that appeals to the youngest voter.
Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, Bernie Sanders is the appeal. And you have Joe Biden and a variety of others are having a really difficult time. And then the younger element of the cohort running for the Democratic nomination are having a very difficult time. And I don't see the young, aspiring leader coming forward to represent younger voters on the Democratic side. And then also you have this real split. I think the Democratic Party right now doesn't have an identity. You have a split between what would be called the traditional Democrats and the more progressive wing of the Democrats. And healthcare is a great illustration of that split. And thus far, no one has been able to broker the chasm between those two elements.
So where would a third party or alternate party movement originate? Who would lead that?
I think some person, maybe a person who's dissatisfied with their current party, such as a Lincoln, decides that they're going to be attached to a newer party. The newer party will probably start at a grassroots level, state and local, maybe in one of the more populous states like New York, California, Florida, and say that we're tired of both the parties not representing the interest of the people. We want to do this differently. And some person that was attached to one of the two major parties says, yes, I agree with that, and comes forth and becomes a leader.
So how does a third party candidate get enough support from the so-called establishment, from Republicans and Democrats? They would presumably need some. Thinking back to 1992, people went to support Ross Perot as the independent candidate. Some Republicans feel that cost George Bush a chance at re-election because they split the conservative vote and Bill Clinton ended up winning. Some people may take that as throwing away their vote. How do they move past that so a third party candidate can truly emerge and win?
Well, one of the things that they have to do, and the same thing happened with Ralph Nader. Some people argue that's happened with Jill Stein in the last election. And one of the things that has to be done is not to start at the national level. Because for a third party to survive in this country, you have to start changing the rules at the local and state level as to how you get on the ballot. Right now, state ballot directives make it very difficult for a person not representing a major party to get on the ballot. And you have to change that. You also have to be a big proponent of fair districting. Because redistricting right now is designed to keep the two parties around, and you need to change that. And so that's where you start. You don't start with necessarily a candidate. You start changing the election machinery to make it possible that a third party can actually make it in this country.
Well, that gets to the next point I was going to make about safe redistricting that we've seen evolve over the last several decades and the presence of big money in campaigns. Those in power seem interested in maintaining the status quo, while newcomers into the political fray want to change that but have not been able to do it. How does a new candidate or a new party break through and completely turn the political dynamic upside down?
First of all, you start with the election machinery. You mentioned another element that keeps the two parties around, which is money. And a couple of things that you do is you hope that a presidential candidate gets in that is able to make some personnel adjustments on the Supreme Court so that the Citizens United case gets overturned. You start arguing for a public budgeting option for candidates, and you start dealing with campaign finance reform seriously as a third party, as a movement, saying that money's too directive here. We, the people, are losing our voice. You know, there's 100 of us to less than one person, and that one person's able to control elections simply because they have more money than 100 of us put together. We need to change that.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Bob Briley, Professor Emeritus of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. He's hosting a talk at the McLean County Museum of History on October 10th, drawing parallels between the presidential elections of 1860 and 2020. We seem to have the middle dropping out of the public discourse. The voter base back then was more homogenous. Did the limited franchise back in the 1850s and 60s have an effect on the politics then that's not there today, encouraging a middle ground?
Well, yes. One of the things that I see as an element as to why 2020 may end up being a critical election with one or both parties either substantially changing or disappearing is the rapid, significant growth of independents. So it used to be independents were people that would say they're independent, but essentially would be Republicans or Democrats in elections. But what we're seeing right now is more true independents who are not associated with the party, in fact, dislike both the parties. And we're seeing that more and more. In 1860, we saw that even though at that time we weren't gathering data on independence, because you had a substantial amount of the people, those who did have the ability to vote, were dissatisfied with the parties on the primary issue, which was slavery. And you had the parties trying to make some accommodation, saying, well, we'll end slavery, but we won't do it very quickly. We'll end slavery only in the areas where it's most pressing, you know, things like that. And that didn't appeal to those who wanted slavery gone, and it didn't appeal to those who wanted slavery to remain intact, unchanged. And particularly the Democratic Party and the Whig Party both suffered from that immensely. Trying to do what you were suggesting, and that is trying to appeal to the middle, and it didn't work.
And it seems as if the expansion of slavery or Lincoln's efforts to fight that expansion led some to say he was not a legitimate president, which is a term that we heard in the last election after Trump won. Because of the Russian involvement in the election, some said he wasn't a legitimate president, and we've heard it in other examples in our time. Some fear that if Trump loses next year, that he will claim the election is rigged. He already claimed the last election was rigged when he won. So are we looking at that dynamic rearing its head again in 2020?
And we could. And one of the things that really struck me is one of the things that has been a hallmark of our nation, and I hope that this continues, is the peaceful transfer of power. That one candidate attached to one party loses and says, okay, and doesn't try to, you know, to get the people to fight that decision with going to the streets and violence. And you've seen indications of that from Trump. Well, there were candidates in 1860 that talked about that, and that if we became too welcoming to immigrants, there would be blood in the streets. And we should adopt an anti-immigrant policy now, even though that might lead to some bloodshed, because if we don't, then there'll be a whole-scale war in this country. And I was just struck by the parallels between that.
So immigration, once again, playing a prominent role in this election in much the same manner.
Right. And for those who think that immigration is a new problem that we're wrestling with, it was a huge issue in the public opinion leading up to the 1860 election. And in fact, there were elements, just as there are today, there were elements of both parties that were very anti-immigrant. And this was the immigration flow from Europe. basically from Germany and Ireland. We had elements of this anti-immigration play out in Bloomington. There were certain measures taken locally, directly against the Germans. There were some measures taken against the Irish. This is part of the temperance movement because it was the stereotype was that Irish drank a lot. Well, to keep them from drinking, being disruptive and stuff like that, let's adopt temperance.
Retired ISU politics and government professor Bob Bradley. He says we often forget in our focus on what's happening that many things have happened before in history, and history can guide us to solutions today. He says the Civil War is a reminder that there were times when America was more divided than it is now. Bradley spoke with Eric Stock.
Partnering with WGLT works for Chestnut Health Systems.
Our society is faced with some tough healthcare issues. As a service provider, it's important that we tell the community about all that we're doing. I'm Puneet Liga, Chief Operating Officer at Chestnut Health Systems and Chestnut Family Health Center.
And Chestnut is a new WGLT underwriter.
I think the WGLT audience is community-minded and engaged in current issues.
Partnering with WGLT works for Chestnut Health Systems. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, Laura Kennedy helps us stitch up a new art exhibit. There are lots of days left in the summer and fall for turf grass to grow. Chance, though, you might be spending way too much time and money on maintaining your lawn. In this edition of WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, Mike McCurdy and ISU's Patrick Murphy talk about lawns.
Front and center at most of American homes is a lawn. Turf looks simple, but sometimes is everything but simple. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick, thanks for stopping by to talk about the different types of turf for different uses, how to care for it, and why we actually have it. Why do you think we like it so much? Why is it an obsession for some people?
Oh, I love talking to you about this because I know we both love a lawn and we love it in different ways. I see the lawn as kind of a symbol to lots of people. So if you're the executive that goes to work and wears a suit, well, your lawn is kind of the suit for your house. Hmm. Now, if you're a working man, tradesman, tradeswoman, and you have an expertise or a trade or a craft, well, you know, your lawn is now an example of your attention to detail and your meticulous understanding of your craft. So it represents something for everybody, I think.
Can it actually benefit a home in some ways?
There's plenty of evidence that suggests that a good turf lawn can increase the property value by 5 to 15% because of its ease in maintenance.
Interesting. Yeah. So what makes turf beautiful to you?
In any setting, the thing that makes turf beautiful, so when I say any setting, if it's the layperson gazing on a great big corporate lawn, you know, or the entrance to a park, or a professional, or a person like you or I that are just trying to do our best with the chunk of the world, it's color, density, lack of weeds and unwanted plants, maintainability, and lasting seasonal utility. So you can play bocce ball out there as long as you're able to go outside.
There is something pleasing, though, to the eye about the consistency of a well-maintained lawn, that monoculture. Can you sort of achieve this with similar grasses or some other plants that actually strengthen the resiliency of the lawn without detracting from that carpet look? I mean, if you have some clover mixed in, is that going to be a big deal from a distance?
I think it's a preference and taste issue, you know, so it depends on the distance, right? So if it's for people just driving by in your normal residential area, they may see some of the clover changing the appearance of some of the turf in some areas. But, you know, if you're just driving by on a highway and you're, you know, looking at the off-ramp for the next town or whatever, there's grass there too, and it looks green like carpet, but there's all kinds of plants mixed in there.
There are lawns and then turf for other purposes. You talked about play fields a moment ago. Could the playfield approach even apply to someone's lawn, a home lawn, a backyard, someplace with kids and pets? Would you want a more durable playfield than actually that manicured lawn?
I think that there's a lot of the characteristics of a playfield are useful in a lawn setting, and they kind of lend towards the maintainable, easy part of life, too. Playfields and lawns differ in perception and view. So turf on the playfield is often chosen and cultivated to withstand what's going on that playfield. Football, for example, that's hard on the turf. So is baseball and soccer because they're wearing the cleat, right? And some play fields are seated with a blend that affords for this range of activities as well as mowing heights because they're playing football in the fall, but they're playing baseball in the spring. So growing conditions differ during different times of activity that are there.
And some of this you could apply to your backyard. If you have two dogs and five kids, you're going to want a play field. You're not going to want a nice whole lawn full of bluegrass.
I totally agree with that, but we see the opposite of that all the time. But I think that if people were to give it a try and maybe practice some of the playfield tactics of letting that grass get up over the top of your shoe and mowing it at that height, it still has this beautiful manicured look. And I think that the density part of the turf gauging standard, I think that becomes realized more so when there's depth in the turf.
General rule, cut it high, never cut more than a third off. Is that about right?
That's a great rule of thumb.
I have an opinion, and I think you share this opinion with me, about too much of a good thing when it comes to turf. It does take a lot of maintenance. It does take a lot of water. It can take, if you want, chemicals or at least natural products, fertilizer, to keep it looking green and healthy.
I think that we do share the point of view on the lawn because I don't play golf, but I see the beauty in golf courses. I see the beauty in parks, and I see the arcs and tangents of different plants as they occur in nature. It could be on the side of a mountain, or it could just be in a meadow when you're out at Parklands taking a walk. The front yard, for example, is really a good smart place to have at least a portion of the front yard, a nice manicured lawn that leads the eye and people's feet to your front door. Well, but then it's useful to have some turf in the backyard too. So, you know, you can do the full contact football stuff with the misses and not have to worry about tearing up the grass. But the turf in the back may be mowed at a taller height. It may have a little more weeds than the front does. So, yeah, I think that we can exercise some of that understanding and also want everybody to know that's easier to take care of and it requires less fertilizer, less pesticide. Mm-hmm. And then your planting areas, look at them as your roughs. You know, those are the areas that you're letting the plants do all the work and block out the things you don't want to see and don't want to hear. Yeah, I think that is the approach. It's a blended approach.
Yeah, I've actually worked to reduce the amount of turf in my yard simply because I just get tired of mowing, and I think the plants that I have growing in the beds are more interesting than just a field of green.
Yeah, and absolutely, too. And what we know about being in a relationship with the environment and helping restore natural cycles that are there, I think, you know, just having the entire yard covered with grass is beautiful and nice, but you're not realizing the full potential of your property.
Can you tell me about the intersection of horticulture, botany, and biology with the American lawn? What are you talking about?
I think it's the blended approach that we were kind of kicking around just a second ago that recognizes the merits of each of these disciplines. A more groomed entry and public space wrapped by a rough that conceals unwanted views, your neighbor's camper, etc. And it even includes some native plants along with edibles. And then you have some special non-native or adaptive plants that you're displaying because they're a reflection of your preference and taste. And then, like, that's a ginkgo tree, for example. Now you're using this ginkgo tree as some living sculpture in your yard because the rest of it is part of your connection with nature. It's pleasing to the eye, it's easier to take care of, it's harmonic with nature, and you get to share what you grow to eat.
If you have questions about gardening, such as lawns and turf, let us know, and we might answer it on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
Find this and all of WGLT's podcasts where you find all of your other podcasts, or subscribe at WGLT.org. Thank you. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Artist Aram Han Cifuentes stitches together a communal art experience to give power to those seeking change. The day after the 2016 presidential election, Cifuentes got out needle, thread, and material to craft a protest banner that declared Dump Trump. This was the first in her now ever-expanding protest banner collection, which she operates as a lending library for anyone who wants to borrow a protest banner. Her works are now on view locally. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
University Galleries in Uptown Normal is currently showing We Are Never, Never Other, now through October 13th. The exhibition brings together for the first time three projects by artist Aram Han Cifuentes: Protest Banner Lending Library, U.S. Citizenship Test Sampler, and Amend. Cifuentes drew on her experiences as an immigrant from South Korea to create her community-based textile projects. The artist confronts social justice issues as she invites people to join her in creating. When gallery director and chief curator Kendra Pates invited Cifuentes to show her works at the galleries, the artist says she knew the time was right for this show.
Well, right now, particularly with the political climate that we're in, so much of the rhetoric and attacks are toward immigrants, and particularly immigrants of color. And so all of these works are coming from that place, right? I'm an immigrant of color. And so working with communities of immigrants to make these works, right? So Amend, for example, is collecting scraps from seamstresses and tailors in Chicago, of which all of them are immigrants, right, who came to do this job when they had different sorts of careers, and like being teachers and nurses and businesswomen in their countries that they came from, and they left that behind to become seamstresses and tailors here. And so that work talks about the sorts of work that's available to immigrants. And then U.S. Citizenship Test Sampler is so immigrants, non-citizens coming together to sew the citizenship test questions and answers.
Sew them onto little scraps of fabric.
Yeah, onto linen squares. And that is, we are sewing together to learn the test material together. But of course, conversations come about in terms of how ridiculous the tests are. And, you know, having these samplers exhibited and present that way is also kind of showing these sorts of collection of ridiculous questions that are there, right? And so that, you know, is a statement about, you know, how do we prove ourselves? How do immigrants have to prove ourselves once we're here? And Protest Banner Lending Library is more of a response to the current political climate where we need to make these statements and we need to go out there and protest and fight and talk back to power, which is one of the banners that are out, that's out there, right? To assert ourselves.
Kendra, tell me why you wanted to bring this exhibition into the University Galleries.
The first works I experienced were Protest Banner Lending Library. And I thought, who is this woman? I have to find out more about her. And while the banners exist in one way, you know, they're large, they're colorful, they have these big slogans, they're catchy, they're in your face, they do talk about empowerment. Some of her other works are a little bit more subtle and poetic too, and I thought it was a really exciting opportunity to share the work she's doing, the way she works with communities, the variety of really vital, crucial issues that she's addressing in this work, but to kind of bring these different bodies together where they can inform one another. You can see how her own ethics and politics play out across various bodies of work, because at times it's really poetic and subtle, and at times it's really like grabbing you, you know, by the face and saying, look at this, listen to this. But I don't think it's ever enough to just bring work into the community, but thinking about how can people engage with the issues, whether we're meeting with classes, whether we're doing workshops, whether we're putting the artist sort of face to face with students and community members. So throughout the course of the exhibition, there will be a wide variety of opportunities where people can either interact directly with the artist or the people the artist has trained. We'll have materials available where people can make their own protest banners, whether or not Aram is even here with us. So we're really excited about these different ways that maybe we can get people either, one, paying attention to these issues if they're not already, or thinking about a different perspective on them that perhaps they just haven't even begun to wrap their head around, or showing support for people who already know all about this, but this is just another way to think about the materials and the message and the ways that we come together.
Aram, your projects are community-based, and I'd like to know why you decide to do that, and is there sometimes a little danger in that things could get out of hand, that they could be sort of taken out of your hands as an artist? How do you feel about that?
I'm naturally an extrovert, so I'm a people person. I do like to be in my studio and make my own work by myself, but a lot of times I want to make with other people, and I want to share how I make with other people. I want people to share how they make with me, and so particularly with the issues that I'm making work around, it's affecting so many people and so much of my communities, right? My family, neighbors. And so it just made sense to make with other people.
While you're working with other people, did you ever find yourself hearing something and then getting hit with inspiration and then thinking, well, now I need to go in this direction?
Always. Because there's only so much you can control, or you think you can control, right? When you're working with complex people, having that flexibility and that openness to, you know, not like dictate what things are, but to have kind of a fluid working space is really important for me. And so, yeah, projects change all the time because of that, right? And so, for example, the U.S. citizenship test samplers, initially I only asked people to, participants to just stitch the question and answer and put their name, age, and the year the sampler is completed, responding to traditional samplers. Each of these are on sale for the cost of applying for citizenship. And if sold, the full amount goes to the maker as a gesture.
What's the amount?
Right now it's $725. And so one of the first participants, after they sewed the question and answer, was like, well, this is not gonna sell for that amount. Can I decorate it? And so that's how a lot of the decorations on there came about. Another way that happened, where working with people surprised me or changed the kind of trajectory of the project, changed the project in a different way, was the Protest Banner Landing Library. Initially, I thought that they would just get checked out for protests and marches and political actions, but actually the ways that they get used was really surprising to me, because people, like teachers, take them for their classrooms, theaters have checked them out for their
theater productions?
Yes, for their productions. Yeah, they get used in really surprising ways.
Is the Dump Trump one in there, the banner that says Dump Trump, the first one that started the whole collection? Or has that been checked out?
No, we have that here. We're right now making decisions whether that will go up or not.
Well, that's my next question. Do you feel comfortable putting something like that up? Kendra, do you feel like some of the viewers might be alienated by some of the messages?
Well, I think it's been an exciting exercise for the two of us to go through these banners together. So we didn't have every single banner to choose from, because her work is in demand.
How many do you have?
So there's different libraries in different cities that I've started, but the Chicago one is the biggest one. And I think we have over 400 at the moment.
Which is really exciting. We sat and sorted through them all yesterday and thinking about what are the messages that we need to share, having a balance, thinking about this visual presentation. You know, we have these 16-foot high ceilings, so we're really utilizing that and covering the square footage. We are also sensitive to the fact that we are right in the center of Uptown Normal, and we serve an all ages audience. We have so many programs with K-12 students. So there are a few of the more aggressive ones that we did actually sort of set aside or put into a maybe pile. There is a Trump loves Putin one that we've included.
No, it's Putin loves Trump.
Or Putin loves Trump. That's right. So thinking too about finding some of that balance across the different types of ways that people have created their banner? Like, what are the messages? What are their approaches? Thinking visually, too, in terms of the shape of the banner, the pattern of them, the way the letters are constructed. Trying to show, when there is an archive, that if you only get to show a snapshot of that, how do you find kind of that balance?
Also, the answer to your question in terms of how we selected some of the banners is, like, some of it is so, with what's happening in the world, it's so clear, right?
You're being reactive to what's happening in the headlines.
Yeah, so, like, no guns, right? What was it? Sanctuary, not deportation, right? So, like, some of these are just, we just clearly have to put them up. These messages have to be out there.
That's artist Aram Han Cifuentes, along with University Gallery's director and chief curator Kendra Pates. We Are Never, Never Other runs through October 13th at the galleries in Uptown Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Both Cifuentes and Pates decided not to display the Dump Trump banner that started it all, preferring instead the banner emblazoned with Putin Loves Trump. You can hear more about the exhibition, plus see photos at our website, wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, Laura Kennedy, Mike McCurdy, Patrick Murphy, and I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. Or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.